This is Within and Between, a podcast about the methods and meta-science behind developmental science. Hi, it's Jessica Logan.
And it's Sarah Hart.
And welcome back to an episode of Within in Between.
Welcome.
Today, we are live at Purdue University. Can I get everybody to go hi?
Hi.
Yay. We have a room full of people who are looking at us right now.
Yeah, it's a little bit surreal, honestly. Very different than the closet.
It is very different. Normally, I'm looking at my pants right now. They hang right there.
Yeah, exactly. So today we were thinking about what other types of hidden curriculum things we could talk about at this this little conference that we're doing, and started thinking about all of the hidden curriculum involved in authorship. So how do you decide who should be an author? How do you decide what order authors should go in? How do you advocate for yourself that you think you should be an author? What kinds of rules exist around that? And there's just so much of it. I had two or three students in my office last week asking me questions about this, which is part of why it came up.
Yeah, and I'm teaching my professional development class this semester, and I taught about writing and authorship, and I'd say things like, "Well, this is how it works, but only in this instance."
Yeah.
"And this is how this works, but only if you're working with collaborators in this subfield." And I was like, this is just such a rife topic for so much hidden curriculum. Mm-hmm. And, it can be really confusing.
It can be really confusing. So, I think that what we've done to sort of prepare for today is we've gone through a bunch of different authorship rules of authorship mm-hmm. that exist. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about the COPE, we're going to talk about APA, and we're going to talk about something called the credit model. So those are the three big ones we're going to talk about. But we're also going to just talk about our own personal experiences, because I think even if you have those rules that exist out there in the world somewhere, that doesn't necessarily mean anybody in our field follows them or understands them. So I like them because they're nice frameworks for you to use to have discussions, but they may not necessarily be the same as how authorship has been operationalized in our day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what I thought would be good for us to start with here is definitions. It's because we're going to talk a lot about different aspects of authorship as mm-hmm. we go through. So mm-hmm. thinking about important, terms. Key terms.
Yeah.
The call-out box at the top of the chapter.
Yes, we're just in that little box right now. So roles on papers. Okay, well, one of the first roles is a first author.
Yeah, first author just usually, technically just means the person that's listed first.
But how do you become first author? Who is the first author? Do you have multiple first authors?
We're bringing up questions.
I know,
I'm going
too far. You're right. Okay, definitions. First author. Yeah, normally the first author is the first person listed in the authorship list. Right. Mm-hmm. And typically, at least for me, and I think for many, the idea is a first author who's listed is probably the person who's done the greatest contribution to the paper.
Yeah.
Probably conceptualized it, has done most of the writing.
Has sort of shepherded it along.
Mm-hmm.
Is the person who has to do all of the revise and resubmits and has to fill out all the paperwork, do all the page proofs.
In most cases,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. So that's the first author.
And then we have contributing author. A contributing author, I think of as just anybody else in the list.
Yeah, if you're an author on the paper.
Yeah, anybody mm-hmm. being an author on the paper. Well, maybe these definitions are easier than I thought they were going to be.
It's that one is defined in the name.
An author,
you have contributed to the paper.
Unlike first author, which is not right in the name. The author who's first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, well, we'll move on to maybe one of the harder ones. Corresponding author.
The author you correspond with?
Yeah.
That one might be obvious too.
I'm pretty glad I spent a long time coming up with what we needed definitions for.
So a corresponding author is usually is the person who submits the paper to a journal, and so they have to do all the journal interface to submit that paper, the manuscript for consideration at the journal. And then if the journal accepts the paper, then the corresponding author is the one who does gets the emails from the journal, and then is the one who's listed on the final manuscript, the published manuscript, as the contact for that paper. So they're supposed to be the one responsible for answering questions, who you could contact if you find a mistake in that paper or are interested in following up about that paper. Mm-hmm. Then that's the person whose contact information is fully listed on the manuscript.
Yeah. Then we have senior author, or I have in parentheses mentoring author ? Because mm-hmm. I had not heard that, and I think David said it earlier today, and I think you've said it as well. The mentoring author is like the more senior person on the manuscript?
Yeah. So senior author, that idea of senior author, at least first, is I think comes more from like the bench STEM sciences, where there's a PI of a grant, and then they're considered the senior author. So if you've got the funding or you're the PI of the lab, then you're typically considered the senior author. You've contributed you got the funding to support the research that's in that paper. And in the STEM kind of bench sciences, they differentiate senior author from, let's say, first author, because they're not necessarily the person who's written the paper, but you're the person who really got the funding. And that can be different from the first author.
And that's not like indicate. So like corresponding author is indicated by like a little asterisk or like some sort of super text?
Yeah, there is some information on the front of the paper when you look at a manuscript who the corresponding author is, and the first author is noted being the first person in the position.
Yeah, but senior author,
it's usually not, it's not noted anywhere on the paper.
No, but colloquially often is the last author.
In some subfields.
And in others, that means that you did the least.
Yes.
And we're going to really. Hence the problem.
This is where we start getting into the hidden curriculum stuff a little bit.
I know. Yeah. Gosh.
And then mentoring author, sometimes I differentiate that if it's a student in my lab, but we're working on a data set that has a different senior author who received the funding.
Gotcha.
So I fully mentored the student in writing the paper, but I'm not in the senior authorship slot, wherever that is, and we'll get into wherever that is, because I didn't get the funding for that data. And so sometimes I maybe differentiate the mentoring author, but that is...
What?
That is not... I would say that's probably not a common thing.
Oh my gosh. Interesting. Well, that brings me right here to personal experiences. Yeah. What an excellent transition you have for me. Mm-hmm. Because I'm in an interesting position because I do so much of my work is collaborative, as mm-hmm. we've established on this podcast in the past. So I'm working a lot with many different PIs and many different labs. So I've authored papers across lots and lots of people and sort of the folded into their authorship standards and like ways of practicing authorship. So I've seen lots of different ones, mm-hmm. but I feel like it's slightly different for you because you really lead much more of a traditional lab mm-hmm. setting. So I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about the way that you do this for papers that come out of your lab.
Like how we think about authorship positioning.
Yeah, let me actually ask the question that leads this, which is how do you determine if someone is an author mm-hmm. and how do you determine order of authorship?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to not do this in an hour. So it usually sorts out fairly cleanly who first author is in my lab. So that is usually either a student or a postdoc in my lab mm-hmm. who has an idea or is interested in leading one of our major ideas from the lab. So sometimes you have like a major paper idea that's like one of the aims of a grant. You know it has to be written. And a student or like a mentee is like, you know, I'll lead that or I'm interested in that. Or they come up with their own idea with data you have in the lab and they're like, I want to lead that. And so we usually sort out pretty easily in the lab. It's the person who's going to really take control of the paper. It's their idea or they're taking ownership of the idea and they're writing the paper, they're doing the analyses, you know, all of that may be supported and scaffolded with other, you know, with me or potentially others, but it's there's like one person in charge of this little paper baby and that's the first author. I love paper bees. Yeah. And so my lab doesn't typically do like multiple first authors, right? So there are some models, especially coming from the bench STEM sciences, where they have multiple first authors. We've not done that in my lab. So it's one person takes charge of the paper. That's the first author. For then other authors on the paper, the contributing authors, so typically I'm always an author as a mentor because I'm involved in all the in all the steps of the way, and often I've gotten the funding and collected the data. You know, we have big group meetings with, I call it the writers group. I think we've talked about that before on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
So like anybody in my lab who like tends to write on data in my lab. So that's often just graduate students and postdocs, but it can be other, you know, graduate students from other labs and the like can come. And so we talk about each paper that's in development in the lab at that group meeting that happens every week. And sometime, you know, where it's like, it's when we're at the conceptualization stage,
sure.
that it's like, who wants to come on this paper? You know, so we have the lead that's kind of set, you know, who else is interested in this topic that wants to be involved in this paper? And we have those discussions kind of generally. And so some of the students raise their hands. And so they're either coming on, maybe it's a junior student who's the first author. So a senior student's going to come on to help with the analysis. Or it's a topic that multiple students or multiple mentees in the lab are interested in. And so, you know, like, oh, I want to be involved in that because I'm also writing a similar companion paper. And so let's everybody kind of be involved in each other's papers.
Huh. So wait, at that point when you're asking, like when people say, hey, that's me, I want to do that,
mm-hmm.
is that the end of it? Or do they say, I want to do that and I want to do this specific thing?
Sometimes we sort that out. I will say in my lab, when you first author a paper, you do tend to take ownership of almost all parts of the paper.
Oh.
So that's different than other labs where there might be more of a collaborative writing situation where, you know, you'll jump on and everyone like splits up all of the writing, and that's mm-hmm. the author's. We've sometimes done that. I haven't found it to be super successful personally for how my lab works. And so generally, if you're first author, it's anticipated you're going to do most of the writing. If another mentee in the lab is coming on the paper, they're either going to oversee or help you with the analyses, or they're going to and maybe help write that up, or maybe do a small section of the introduction because they've already, you know, they're working in that same topic area and they're kind of familiar with the literature. So they'll come in and help with some of the intro or just really help with the conceptualization all the way through. But we don't really have a model where it's like, okay, there's going to be four people. So you take the intro, you take the methods, you take the results, you take the discussion.
Okay.
It's really the first author is expected to shepherd all the way through and might farm out small pieces of to the contributing authors who are coming on.
Okay, so it's like that person's kind of like the project manager of the paper baby.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna use that forever. That's great. Paper baby. That makes sense.
Yeah. And so those are typically then, so that's like the mentees in the lab of people who are coming on. Then there are contributing authors who are part of that paper for the sake that they were investigators on the grants that contributed to that paper.
Mm.
And so that means that they had a different role at an earlier stage in the research process of conceptualizing the broader grant idea and the collection of the data. And by being a part of the investigator team that got that money, then in my lab, that means that you have, you're automatically an author unless you opt out.
Yeah.
And so then they also get tacked on as contributing authors, and we intersect with them. You know, you have co-investigators usually that round out your expertise in other areas. And so if the, you know, if that co-investigator, you know, has, let's say, for example, I have a grant right now where we have a mental health component, right? And my expertise is not necessarily in mental health, but I have a clinical psychologist co-investigator who does mental health in children. And so if the paper is specifically oriented to mental health, then we'll really activate her on that paper. She is open to being on all of the papers. It's her choice to not be on the paper if she doesn't feel like she meets authorship for that paper. But otherwise, you know, the investigators on the grant get to be on that paper. So those are the other contributing authors.
And do you have some sort of like documentation of that, or is it just agreement and you're sort of chatting in the room? And I just remember that you said you were going to be on this paper.
Yeah, it's more
option two.
Yeah. In prepping for this podcast, though, we looked at many good, proper, written agreements. And we're going to talk about those in a bit, I think. And I have considered that potentially that would be a better idea for me than these oral situations. Because what ends up happening, and this is happening right now with a paper where we're almost done a pre-registration, or we're almost done this one is actually a registered report. And so I've been working closely with the student who's running it. And then she's like, okay, well, who are the final authors on this paper as we go to submit it? And I was like, who in the lab said they wanted to be involved in this paper? Ooh. And especially since many times the other students are involved in the analysis phase or whatever, where we haven't gotten to that in the pre-registration of the registered report. And so then my memory is spotty at best. And so then I'm always like dependent on the usually younger brain to remember who said that they wanted to be involved. So I think some sort of written record would probably make this system better for me in my lab. But currently that's not how we do it.
Yeah, more formalized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess that... So if you have something that comes up where someone says, oh, I thought I was going to be second author and now I'm not,
mm-hmm.
does that happen to you? Do the people come to you with like grievances?
Grievances?
Sure. grievance light about I really wanted to be second author and now this person has pushed me to fourth and I'm not happy about this?
No.
It's just because you're happy, just a happy-go-lucky lab with
we
paper
keep up.
Babies.
We're pretty good. And I think we keep really good communication about it all the way through. Uh-huh. And people are pretty confident where they are. We also don't run into situations where people have done a considerable amount of writing so then expect to be second author, because the first author is really in my lab, the one who's taking ownership of almost all of the paper. So, it has not come up. Now, that being said, do I recognize that potentially mentees in my lab are having conversations between themselves and not coming to me about it or thinking in their head they've been upset about a situation that I'm not aware of? I think I would be naive to think that maybe that hasn't happened and I'm not aware of it and we should have a formal system so that that is not occurring.
All right. Well, let's talk about formal systems.
Yeah, well, because you've worked with somebody, right? You work with many people, and like you said, and so you tend to always be a collaborating author.
Yeah.
And so you've seen many different systems across different PIs and how they handle authorship.
That's very true. Mm-hmm. And I've definitely worked with some people who handle it similar to you, which is kind of like a verbal, just sort of a discussion mm-hmm. where you're saying, hey, do you want to come on this paper? I'll make you an author. And that's kind of the end of that. Usually the system, I would say that's probably the most common that I see. And then oftentimes what will happen is at the very end, we'll have one meeting with anybody who was an author and say, all right, who did what? Who did the most? You're going to be first. Who did the least? How do you feel about us moving you up or down in authorship order, depending on contribution? So in most of the papers that I collaborate with people, it tends to be the first author did the most work, second author did the second most work,
mm-hmm.
and so on. There are a few exceptions. So like there are some papers that I've worked on where like there's three or four investigators and it's a major grant aim from the investigator of the research, like the funded research project. And so those three or four people will be first and then other contributors would come after that. But that's only happened a handful of times. So there's that. But then the other system that I have is I have a couple of people who have formal documents, like an authorship and data use agreement that you sign, you fill out, you sign, you say, here's the title of the paper, here's where I'm going to submit it. It's going to be a journal article, or it's going to be a dissertation, or it's going to be a presentation. Here's an abstract. And it gives everybody who's on the potential authorship team an option to opt in or opt out. And so you record then at that early stage who's going to be on this paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that is pretty nice. It does keep you accountable in both ways. Like it keeps you accountable if you later on are like, wait, why am I not an author on this? Then you can open it up and say, oh, because I didn't say I was going to be an author on this paper. The number of times I've done that is zero. Never happens. Or the opposite, which is like someone will say, hey, I thought you were going to be working on the methods or results for this paper. And then I say, what are you talking about? And then they say, here's the authorship agreement. And I say, haha, my bad. Forgot about that for the last 6 weeks. Sorry. I'll get right on that. So it makes it really nice that you have sort of a record. And in that case, when people opt in to be an author, you have to say, I'm going to do X. This will be my contribution. Mm. I will read behind on the introduction, or I will provide a first draft of this part of the discussion because I know we're going to be talking about this piece that's in my area of expertise. So I really like that in terms of sort of knowing what to expect from co-authors. I know that I can count on you to write the section on the importance of peers in the preschool classroom. I don't know nearly enough about that, but I know that you do, so we can, you know, get that written. So that's really nice. And that comes from the APA style model.
Mm.
How was that transition? That was not great. Well, I'm going to go with it anyway.
Yeah.
So it's the APA rules is the first place that I went to sort of think about our formalization of rules in terms of who should be an author. And so,
yeah, well, let me step in for a second because, you know, what we've talked about so far, like, oh, what I've done in that space, a little bit of the lab that I grew up in as a graduate student, yeah. What they did. And so, you know, you just kind of pick up the culture that you were trained in and maybe continue that or fix it that works best for you. But in reality, there are some like set recommendations out there, you know, that help, you know, can help you through these conversations or help you determine for your lab, you know, what might work best so that you don't get into situations where people are like, I should have either been an author on this paper and I'm not an author on this paper.
Yeah. Or I thought you said I was an author on this paper, but we don't actually, but you haven't been involved.
Nobody has a record of it. Yeah. Or, you know, you think that you're this level of author and you're not that level of author. You think you're supposed to be second author, but you end up being fifth author. Or it also happens sometimes where, and this has happened occasionally in my lab, where somebody is supposed to be first author, but the person who's assisting or part of that ends up doing more work. And it kind of feels like sometimes maybe, and then sometimes it happens if somebody's transitioning out of the lab or transitioning out of academia, and they can't take on all the first authorship stuff. But they, in my mind, they were always the first author, so they continue to be the first author. And so sometimes can end up in weird situations too. And so having some sort of guidelines, I think, is helpful. Yeah. And they exist. There are guidelines that exist to help you put together how the process that you might have in your own lab to do this.
It's a much better transition. Professional.
Not my first podcast.
All right, so I'm going to start with the APA rules. And the APA rules, they basically have, they talk about what does it mean to be an author?
Mm.
So, like, how does a person now say, yes, I should be an author on this manuscript?
Okay.
Does that make sense? Yes. I'm saying yes. I didn't give you a chance to respond.
No, okay. Give me a little bit more.
All right, so authorship for them, they say authorship is reserved for persons who make a substantial contribution to a work and accept responsibility for a published work. So it's both of those things. Mm. Both you have to contribute substantially and you have to accept responsibility for what comes out. So what's a substantial contribution? That's a little bit tricky.
Does the APA say what a substantial contribution is?
Well, the APA really pushes you towards something called the credit model. The credit model, which is it's credit contributor roles. And I don't remember what credit stands for.
It's various uppercase and lowercase letters that must stand for some sort. It's an acronym of some sort.
It's an acronym of some sort, but it's definitely made by someone from our generation because the vowel is still there. I feel like anybody in this generation making acronyms, they just chuck those vowels out. So that they lean on the credit model in terms of coming up with what substantial contribution means.
The APA says use the credit model.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it also ties nicely. Gosh, there's so many of these. It ties nicely into the rules of Vancouver, which I really like. I didn't even say I was going to talk about those.
What are the rules of Vancouver?
Well, we have three possible things that you have to do in order to be an author from rules of Vancouver.
Okay, so the rules of Vancouver, the APA, the rules of Vancouver sets out what they think should be to be an author on a paper. You should tick these boxes.
Yeah.
Okay, so what did they say?
It's the same idea, just sort of written a little bit more explicitly, because the first one is contribute substantially and take ownership, like authorship. Hold on. accept responsibility. Nailed it. First try. So what the rules of Vancouver say is that you've got to do three things. You have to contribute substantially to the development of the design of the study, the collection of the data, or the analysis and interpretation of the data.
Mm-hmm.
Also have written parts of the publication or reviewed the publication closely and approve the final version of the manuscript before submission. And I think that that aligns really well with how pretty much I would expect someone to be an author.
Yeah, that's how it would work in my lab as well. So contributed to development or design. So that's like, and we're in the room with all of the mentees, and we're talking about the idea, you know, and every week we come back to that paper and ask, you know, connect with it and like, where is it in the process? If you read any papers or if you want to show any data, you know, can you help us think? Here are the results. What discussion points should we focus on? So people are part of that. Conceptualization, or they are investigators and they contributed substantially to the initial development of the idea of the grant.
Right.
And so that definitely we tick off in my lab, at least written parts of the publication or reviewed the publication closely. Mm-hmm. I would expect all co-authors to read the publication. Some may read at multiple drafts at certain sections. Some may just read the whole final version of it. But we don't ever submit a paper that at least all of the co-authors have not said they're either fine with it or they've given us comments back.
Yeah. So we've got all three of those things, which is, I think, a nice benchmark for whether you should be an author or not. Now, in terms of contributed substantially, we're still at that contributed substantially. Like, what does that even mean? And that's where the credit model comes in.
Okay.
So the credit model, the credit contributor rules, there are 14 of them, and I won't read them because that would be incredibly boring. But there's 14 roles that they say you can you could meet to contribute. So one of them is conceptualization, which we already talked about. But there's also things about methodology, even project administration, data visualization, plus writing. So it's got all of these different pieces, and if you we'll link to this in the show notes so that you can see example credit statements. So it'll say things like, this person did these specific parts of the publication.
Yeah, one of these 14 parts.
Mm-hmm.
You list their names and what of the 14 parts that person contributed to.
Yeah.
And it's becoming more and more common for journals to request the credit statement.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're submitting a paper, you may have seen it. They're like, okay, here, you give the authors, and then you're like, okay, in the author note or some other place, you know, you write every author name and you write what they contributed using the credit contributor roles, the 14 of them. And so that any reader of the manuscript has a better idea of the role of each of those authors on the paper, you know, because not everybody likely contributed to the statistical analysis.
Right.
Not everybody got the grant funding. And so it allows any kind of consumer of that paper to understand the role of that person on the project, on the paper.
Mm-hmm. And so what I like from the credit statement is I like the idea that when you're starting out, you can sort of draft a basic credit statement. You can write a credit statement about all of the people who are going to be involved in the process so that you have a sort of shared agreement of what people are looking at and what people are going to contribute. And then revisiting that toward the end to say, is this actually how this shook out? Did you actually write the introduction you said you were going to write? Or did you not? And if not, what does that change? And who do we put in the credit statement in that spot? Mm-hmm. So I like that in terms of a sort of a form to make sure that people are contributing to those three in those three ways. Contributing substantively, reviewing or writing drafts of the manuscript, and approving of the final. Yeah. You found this really interesting tidbit because we were wondering how, first of all, one of the things I was wondering is how many of these things exist? I know about these three or four that I've mentioned.
Like authorship systems. Way of thinking about who is an author and how you apply author.
Yeah. And so I looked up on Google Scholar authorship attribution because I was just curious what's coming up with authorship attribution. And I want you all to know that Google Scholar found 17,000 results for authorship attribution.
So there's been 17,000 papers written about authorship.
Yes, we're using this within quotes, authorship attribution. So lots of them exist.
We are not going to review all 14,000 today.
No. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that we're not going to make
we're
it
not
through
do
all
that.
14,000.
No, we're not going to do that.
But I think that it just, we like navel gazing here in academia. We like thinking about the way we do work. So a lot of people have put a lot of thought into how these things work. And I think that each field has different, you know, there are field-specific authorship agreement type things out there. And I like these. Huh, good job. But you also found this really interesting fact that I'm going to make you tell people about.
So, you know, you would think that potentially your institution might have guidelines for you, right? And somebody has done some meta science work on this and looked to see how many institutions have policies, authorship policies that might help guide you in your institution of how to properly do authorship. And I found this meta science work that said that only 24% of the 266 Carnegie R1 and R2 universities have publicly available authorship policies. So I guess, you know, to cut to the chase, most of us are flying blind and thinking about how to do authorship and thinking about, you know, how to assign authorship, what makes you an author, and the authorship order. Because everything we're talking about here, so we just talked about the APA, the Vancouver style. We're going to have a couple more that we're going to talk about. But that none of those tell you a little bit about who should be author and how you should have those conversations and what contribution gets you into the authorship slot. But they don't. They all very explicitly say that it's within your field of how you determine the authorship order. Mm-hmm. And so even that continues to be blind and I think is rife with hidden curriculum as well. I kind of want to go down that path a little bit. I'm going to take us off.
I think off that's, yeah, let's do it.
Because I think we skipped over this a little bit in that the order, right? So like, okay, we talked to you a little bit about some designs of how you decide authorship, but how do you decide order of authorship really is so specific to your subfield. Even, you know, I have to know in my CV, if I'm the senior author on a paper, I have a specific note, it's like an asterisk, on my CV, when I am the senior author on a paper, because you cannot look at any one of my publications and know based on where I am in the authorship of that publication if I'm senior author. Because sometimes I publish in fields or I publish with people more on my genetics side, more in the bench sciences side, more even in psychology, and there's a recognition that last author is senior author. Sometimes I publish more in education journals, which typically recognizes an order of authorship that is based on contribution level. And often the senior author or is the person, the first faculty name after any trainees that get listed.
Yeah.
So it could be second, it could be fourth, and because it's all trainees up until that point. And so sometimes I've used that model and sometimes I use the model where I'm last author as senior author.
And you just like indicated on your CV?
Because there's no other way to know. We talked about this at the beginning of
which one you're following.
Which process I'm following. Because I switch because I'm interdisciplinary and I sometimes switch depending on my field. Mm-hmm. Or I switch depending on the colleagues that I'm working on or the journal that we're publishing in. And I've also switched depending on my career stage. Just to really make things obvious. And where I followed more to development, more of the educational sciences part where I would be, my mentee would be first and I would be second.
Yeah.
And then when I got tenure, I switched to putting myself last. Mm-hmm. And so, this is where I think the conversations are important and talking about it, and because it's not clear when you look at the paper what the contributions of any of these authors. And I guess I'll bring it full circle, Jess.
All right.
This is why these systems, especially like the credit model, can be so useful, where you lay out what the contributions are. Yeah. One of the 14 is got the funding, you know, mentored or supervised it. And that when you have a credit statement that lists out every author and what they've done, then you no longer have to rely on these hidden curriculum tidbits of who does what and what authorship, and you can't tell by just looking at the names and what order those names are in. Instead, we can use this credit model to help us kind of base it doesn't matter where you are, the credit statement tells you exactly what you've done.
Yeah. So then, but the next section of this I would say is, oh my God, this is so much. It's so, I mean, you've told us basically, you plural, have told us basically, it depends. Good luck. So like what, how can we actually take these and put them into operation? Like what kinds of things can we do, or do we suggest that people could try to do, or that maybe we should start doing?
Yeah, you know, when I was first prepping for my class this semester, you know, I always go to Twitter and I ask, you know, like, what professional development topics are people interested in, or what should I cover with the students in my class? And somebody popped into my mentions and was like, you know, I want to tell you about the authorship project that has this great website. And it's some work that was done by colleagues at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And they got an NSF grant, and they're educational researchers mostly. And they have this really slick website called the Authorship Project. They like formalize some of these discussions that you can have. And so I spent a long time in prep for this podcast episode, kind of looking through their website. And it is really nice. And probably they have, so some of the meta science work that I just referred to is actually from that team on how authorship guidelines are set by institutions. And so they link to their own institution and how their institution has instituted some policies. But they also have this really cool form that you can either fill out a PDF, or you can use their Shiny app even, they create a PDF or like a document that puts you through kind of the questions and the conversations you should be having. So it's really a guide to have these conversations, to determine these roles, to determine who the authors are, to determine the authorship order and what people are going to do within that authorship order. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they suggest, of course, at the beginning of the project's the best time, but they make it clear that there's no bad time. You know, well, I guess the bad time is when
after it's published.
Yeah, right? It's done and it's too late.
Don't do it then.
You know, if you're not at the start of a project and you haven't had these conversations, it's not too late. You can still have these conversations and be open about authorship and use their tool that they created to help guide you through that. Okay, so if you look at this form on their website and you use the form to fill it out, it asks questions like, first set of questions are, you know, is this a student-led project? So is this a thesis or a dissertation or a prelims? And then it makes it clear in this form that the field expectations, and this is really kind of across all fields, that if it's a student's thesis or dissertation or prelims, they should be first author. So you have to click buttons related to that. Like, okay, it's a student work, they should be first author. First step. Second step, though, is, and I love this nuance, does that person want to continue with this publication? Are they continuing in academia or not? And I've had this happen where some students are like, yes, I did this for my project, but I'm leaving academia, or it's an undergrad student or a lab staff member, and they're not continuing at all down this path. And so although this was their work, they no longer want to be part of the first authorship, at least of that work. So that's another conversation you can have, because that's a nuance that's important to talk about.
Right? But also, like, as a person who's lived through this and has seen some of my students leave and go to industry with these beautiful projects that have informed the field in really important ways that no one will ever read because they just sit there on a dissertation shelf somewhere.
Yes.
It makes me so sad, but I'd never have seen an authorship form like this, but I would have loved to have been able to say, let me take this work and push it through for you. Mm-hmm. I would love to be able to do that and serve that role to help get this out into the world so that other people know that it exists, because it's such important work.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the first part of this, the conversations and the form that guiding you through these authorship guidelines. And then there's a section on what the work is about, talking about the research questions and stuff. That's more just filling out, giving some background to the form that you're completing. And then there's a section of selecting authors, who the authors are going to be, listing their authorship order, mm-hmm. and their contributions.
Yes.
And they do recommend using the credit model to figure out what those contributions are. So then they link to the credit model and the like. And so then you're literally putting the names down and you're literally selecting what author order those names are going to be and what they're going to do. And then there, maybe forgetting some sections in the middle, but it's not too long. But at one point, another piece that I really love is a section of the form where you fill out what the expected response time from all the authors are for giving feedback on the paper. And what will happen if an author does not meet that timeline? Because it definitely occurs with me. I do big team science where you just lose an author or two and they're not responding. And right, I don't submit a paper unless everybody's responded that they have seen the manuscript to go submission, and it can hold up a paper for a long time.
Yeah.
So part of these guidelines are having a discussion with everyone at the start of the project when everyone's like, cannot wait to do this project, you know, and you're like, okay, great. We're all excited. Here we plan, you know, and they give a recommendation that if you don't hear from an author in a year, it should be expected that that person should, can be removed from the author list. You know, so you can pick your own recommendations for how long it is. We talked a little bit earlier, not on the podcast, but in this room, about how a year goes by so quickly that I'm like, yeah, a year sounds long, but in reality, that seems like totally normal in some people's workflows.
Oh, yeah.
And then the last step of it is everybody signs off on it. So all the authors have a space to sign off that the discussions have occurred, and it becomes kind of like a contract. Obviously, it's not a legally binding contract, but it's like here, it helps you think through and have these discussions of, you know, here is what contributes an author, who the author is going to be, the mm-hmm. authorship order, and what we're going to do if you don't respond or keep up your part of what we all agree to. And so I think it's a really neat tool, and I would like to start to use it in my lab, and I would recommend everybody to check it out. We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah.
But the, you know, this team that thought about this, really, when I was looking through it, I couldn't think of an area that they missed where it can sometimes get a little dicey in authorship, you know?
They did a great job.
Yeah. So I recommend that, the authorship project.
Yeah, it's really easy for us to say, we've solved the problem. Use this form, because we've never used it, so we don't actually know exactly how well it's going to work in
looks
the long
great,
term.
Looks great, though. Looks great.
But it seems like it's going to solve a lot of, or at least provide a really nice framework to have discussions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really about it in terms of authorship. What we really wanted to cover is that it's complicated. There's lots of different sets of rules. Coming to an agreement at the beginning, like having important discussions at the beginning about what rules you will follow and how those will be adhered to, is going to be really important to making sure everybody has a shared set of expectations and those expectations mm-hmm. are being met.
And using the credit model to think about, you know, what kind of roles people can have on the paper as authors,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, considering some sort of written documentation that lays out, you know, you can use the authorship project if you don't want to create it yourself, but lays out, you know, what those roles are going to be. Yeah. Everyone agrees to it at the start so that it's all there and you're not relying on like my really crappy memory to remember who should be authors on the paper when it comes down to like a year and a half later.
And you're not waiting for me for a whole year because I forgot that you asked me to do something.
Yeah.
Both of those are very good.
And I guess in the end, maybe the final recommendation is have conversations about it and be open and to those conversations. Sometimes I can feel really icky, and I don't know why. It's very, but it can. And so, you know, keeping an open air about those conversations so that everybody's in shared agreement is important and will help reduce potential hurt feelings or kind of worse situations.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck. Make a little document.
Go forth an author. Okay. I think now we're going to be doing
questions.
Yes. Yeah, so that was the end of the formal episode, but we're here in a live room. And so we're happy to answer questions. You have us, I think, for a big chunk of time still left to answer questions. And we can answer questions about authorship and include that probably as part of the episode or any professional development topics. We love to talk about professional development, mentoring, anything. So who's got a question? Yes.
Okay, authorship question.
Mm-hmm.
Team science is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Working with other early career researchers is wonderful. Authorship also matters as we're looking for jobs and working towards tenure.
Yeah.
How can we give the most credit possible to our co-authors? It's like, what are your all's thoughts on shared first author and splitting up first author and corresponding author?
You know, I'm thankful you asked this question. I'll restate it because I actually meant to talk about it in the formal episode.
Yeah,
so I'm happy it's going to be here. So, okay. So the question is related to co-first author or splitting up corresponding author and first author. I'm just going to get right into it. I have strong thoughts.
Great.
Okay. I think that we are currently not in a place to understand how to divvy up co-first author.
What does divvy up mean?
Yeah. The credit as part of your question of, you know, who gets the credit for first author. And in many senior people's minds, there is credit for one first author. And that credit is the first name. And so no matter what, in the publication, somebody's name is going to be first. And there may be an asterisk that says there's multiple first authors. In my experience and in my opinion, we don't know how to do that mentally, how to allow for when we're thinking about, you know, a faculty search panel, like, a, you know, faculty search members who are, you know, they don't know how to divvy that up. Do you give 50% to each person? Does each person get 100%? Oh, that doesn't math. And so, you know, and so in the end, it's usually the person who's listed first on the publication. If you want to be extremely controversial on Twitter, is to ask Twitter if it's okay for co-first authors to switch the order of authorship on their CV. So if they're a first author, put their name first on their CV, no matter how they are, because if they're truly co-first authors, they're interchangeable. And whoo!
Yeah. People have strong opinions about that, eh?
Ooh, yeah, you want to light the internet on fire. And it's like every 6 months it comes up and whoo, there's a fire about it. And there's a very strong opinions that the bibliographic record, the DOI, is tied to a specific set of author names in a specific order.
Yeah.
And if you put it on your CV in a separate author, some people view that as lying on your CV.
Yeah.
Many people view that. So then in the end, if we are coming at this from that model, there is no such thing as co-first authorship. There is the person who is named first. And so what I recommend to my trainees, I don't do it in my lab because of that. And what I recommend to my trainees is to not enter into that model, because whoever is listed first gets all of the recognition of being first author. And that is not fair for anybody else who's listed afterwards if they contribute to the same level as that first author. To me, then, when I talk to my trainees and I think about authorship, then there is a lot of importance into that first author role, and that person should be doing the most. And I talk to trainees that if they're a second author, they're likely doing the second most amount of work, but that should be a clear step down.
Mm.
And it shouldn't be close, because all of that credit is going to the first person. And you need to be thoughtful of that. And I want everybody to be working on each other's work and collaborating, and we can help each other out and get more publications for everybody. And I love collaborative work, but you need to be thoughtful of where you are on that authorship order when you're entering into those relationships. So almost all of our episode was about, if you're a first author or a PI, how you assign authorship. But you really should think about it too, as when you are entering into an authorship with another person. And I talk to my students about this. Make it clear what your contribution is going to be. Make it clear to you, and that matches what you think that author order should be. And so, like, I do not think you should be writing a full introduction to be fourth author. You know, that is too much work to me for a fourth author. That may be your contribution. You write the introduction to be second author, and that's all you're doing on that paper. And that might work out. But, you know, you want to be thoughtful of what are you going to be expected to do and what's your authorship role. And I generally do not think that co-first author, because then it's assumed that there's the same amount of work by both people, is a good relationship to be in. In the current model we have right now, where you have all of these much older, more stuck in their way faculty who are viewing your CV and thinking about then who can I give the credit to first author for?
Yeah.
And that does not exist over two people. So my same answer then is for you asked the question of, okay, if it's not co-first author, can one person be contributing author and one person be first author? And just at least my opinion of this is that the corresponding author. Yeah. The corresponding author is literally just the person who hit submit on the manuscript interface. When I was the student all the way through, my advisor had me submit my own papers. And so I was corresponding author. I have my students submit their own papers because, frankly, I don't like dealing with the interfaces. And so they're all corresponding author. To me, it's just literally the person who submitted it. And I don't assign a lot of credit to that role.
No.
And I would say in my psych department, that is the case across all areas. Nobody is talking about who is corresponding author on a paper, and there's no extra credit given to that person.
Agreed.
And yeah, even reviewing other CVs from education and other areas, there is no credit given to corresponding author. It is just simply the person who hits submit in the journal interface. So
one thing about, though, if you have a person who you're close enough with that you could potentially co-first author, then hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Then what I would recommend is that you write two papers. Figure out some way that I guarantee you, you're going to have slightly different questions. You're going to have slightly different ways of approaching it. There's going to be, you could come up with four questions instead of two, and you can split them into two papers. And so you can first one and they can first the other, and you just swap. That would be my suggestion, especially if they're in similar areas. You can basically write very similar introductions because the framing will probably be similar. So I would say split it into two papers, and that would be a much better use of your time and a much better... much easier to understand your contribution.
Yeah. My face was only because I thought you were going to say you could co-first author. To me, then, that's a situation where one person's first author, one person's second author.
Oh, yeah.
And you just switch. And the person who's first author on the paper takes control of it.
Yes.
Yeah. I agree with you.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah. All right. Does that answer your question?
That was great. Thank
yeah.
When you say you've determined the authorship order and then you submit and you get like a revise and resubmit, and then say there's like some conflict about how you respond to reviewer comments the direction that you want to go at that stage, like how do you navigate that? Like, potential.
So conflict, you're thinking like within the group about, so
what
some people.
Like, yeah, within the authors.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Or even like if you're thinking like there's the first author might be a more junior person, and then like there's like the senior author, and there's sort of like a clash of, oh, I think we should do this like analysis or whatever, and you're like, no, I don't think so. And like you're technically, like, you know, there's mm-hmm. kind of like a.
Oh, this power differential dynamic thing is difficult. So I think there's a bunch of answers to that question. And the real answer is it depends. Sorry. But I think that the one of the things that this comes down to is that typically the first author is the one who makes the call.
Yeah.
So the first author can seek input from everyone else, but the first author should make the call. However, if you're in a mentoring situation and the mentor is the person who's making the mentor should be the one who makes that final call. I think you all should be able to discuss it, mm-hmm. hopefully to come to terms with what to do next. But if you are in a mentoring relationship and you hit that disagreement stage, probably the best case scenario is to go with what the mentor says.
Yeah, that was going to be my answer too.
Oh, great.
The first author, if it's an independent person, then to me, the first author makes the final decision.
Yeah.
If the first author is a mentee in a non-independent position, then they still get the call, but they are likely doing it in collaboration with their mentor mm-hmm. to make that decision. And yes, if it comes down to a disagreement between the mentee and the mentor in that decision, then it sucks to say it out loud, but the power differential usually wins out, and the mentor should be the one bad choice of words.
Yeah.
It likely is going to be the one that wins out in making that decision.
Which most of the time is probably a good thing. You know, that's going to be coming from experience. Like that, usually that would be the reason that you would mm-hmm. hope that they're making that call. There are definitely weird exceptions that we don't necessarily need to.
Yeah, that have to do probably with bigger issues in the mentor-mentee relationship.
Yeah.
That is not we're not going to get into to answer your question on, but that definitely could be the case. And that's a sign of something bigger of a situation that's going on between a mentor and a mentee.
Yeah.
But
sort of generally as a rule of thumb, first author makes the call.
Yeah. And that's the case even in the revise and resubmit, or even the, because you know what, if you ask five authors their opinion about a paper, you will get six opinions about the paper. And many very conflicting on the same sentence. I wrote one paper alone and I hated the process, and I only did it because they said I should do it pre-tenure. The collaborative writing process is amazing in getting the feedback and making the paper tighter and better. And so in the end, all those comments are going to make it better, but somebody has to make the decision. And to me, that's the first author. And I think I've worked with many different co-authors, and it's the case that most people enter into the co-author situation assuming the first author is going to make the decision, I would say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering about the credit or weight that is given when you're assessing publications, for example, for hiring, in terms of second, I know first author, that's very clear, but second, third author, maybe they help during the writing, and then you have trading authors playing at the heart of the editing, if that's given equal weight, or also the number of co-authors that are present. Some projects are very collaborative and even community partners, for example, and whether that might, if it seems different or not in your experience.
Yeah, so the question, if it didn't get recorded, was, the kind of the credit based on authorship order. And so it's more clear first author, that's more clear, but, is there other kind of levels of credit that are given to co-authors, second author, or if you have community partners as authors, or if there's a diffusion of credit, maybe if you have, 20 co-authors on the paper. I bet you there might be field differences between this, Jess.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I can respond about psychology, but do you want to respond about education?
Sure. I will say that if I'm looking at CVs, the first thing that we'll look for is, first authorship.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I'm looking for, like you said, second or third authorship. That's sort of indicating to me, even in a long list, if I've got second, actually even more so, in a very long list, the first, four authors or so in a list of 10 are ones where I'm saying, these are the people who did the work. And then after that, I would see someone way farther down in the authorship as someone who has a vague sort of probably read the paper and did a little bit of the work. So this is without a credit statement. You don't really know. So I would say there's less credit given the farther down the list you go, past fourth, slightly less credit, but it's not direct math. And really, the first thing somebody's doing is looking at the total number. So it's how many do you have? How many of them are first author? And after that, how many of them are you in the first couple?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the order that I would look at.
And how many you have are publications.
And how many publications you have, would be one of the first things you look at.
Yeah, I would say there's field differences here. So I'm in a very, very classic psych department. And when we're reviewing candidates for faculty positions and also reviewing for promotion and tenure and the like, there's the total number and the total first author.
That's it?
Yeah. Anything other than first author, you're all the same. Unless you're senior. And then those are senior level positions. This is why I answered the question the way I answered it. That's it. The credit is at first. You're likely the one, in my model, my lab, you're likely the one that did most of the writing. And so that's why I counsel my students to, that you should be very careful in when you are a co-author and how much work you're giving to something.
Yeah.
And I try to help navigate that situation in my lab. Now, there could be other reasons why it could be useful to be a co-author. You might be practicing mentoring skills to the first author or the like that are giving you other skills other than the authorship order. But when we're talking about publications and credit, and at least in my classic psych department, it is first author and then total number. And we literally count those.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question related to that.
Yeah.
I've heard through BIRDS that it's good to have a mix. You want mostly first author, but it's good to be not first author because it shows that you're willing to collaborate. Is that true, or at the end of the day, is that sort of fun?
I think that's field specific too. I would see that as if you sent me a CV and it was only you first author or only you solo author, I would throw up some red flags for me of
mm-hmm.
this is just this person's show. nobody else is at the table. So yes, on my end, yes, that would be, I would be concerned.
Yeah, you know, I was gonna be like, yeah, psych's a little different, but I realize I have seen some CVs where it's a student or a trainee who's applying to a faculty position and it's just them authoring things. And that is a little bit of a red flag. Like, first in our system, where's the mentor in that situation? What's been going on? And why is there no other student? Like, why have they never done anything? But generally, when I recommend to my students they do co-author work, it's simply to increase the N of the total number of publications.
The denominator.
Because in psychology, there's a counting of the total number. That, and less towards the collaborativeness, but also psychology really, the classic psych department likes to work in silos. Yeah. And so it's, you know, a PI and a lab and you work within the lab. You know, that's not me. That's not how you were trained either.
No.
But we're a rarity, you know, for many other classics. And, you know, there could be changing, but I would say think about, you know, the quality and the quantity. And when you're contributing towards the quantity side of things, then you keep your, you maintain what your role is on that paper and you don't give more effort to it than where you are in the authorship list.
That was the opposite energy that I usually get from you.
I know.
That was really interesting.
You're usually like, give.
Oh, yeah, not on that.
Mm-hmm. Not on authorship. But I do think that it shows you can collaborate. And ultimately, if you're thinking about job, getting hired at a job, the people who are reviewing your CV are looking for someone who's going to come in and be a collaborator, could be a team player. Is going to be someone who will, or at least is going to pick up their bit of the service. It's going to be a kind, nice colleague. Maybe in education, we're concerned about people being kind and nice colleagues. And in psychology,
there's a little bit more, than just
bring them in.
Yeah.
Who's going to be on the front page of the newspaper?
How much have you written? Yeah.
Okay.
But that is definitely not a blanket statement. And, you know, it is fairly common these days, like we all are interdisciplinary and collaborative, right? And that is usually a great calling card to go forward on the job market with. And so that can also be something that's included in your job talk or when you're talking with people that this is something you're interested in. You work the interdisciplinary ways, you work across people, you like to collaborate. And if the department is into that, they'll love that about you. And it doesn't necessarily have to just be because you've co-authored with lots of people. You know, you can show it in many ways. And if it's not a department that, you know, thinks that that's amazing, then it's either not the right place for you or they're trying to change and they're going to catch you up because you can help change the culture.
But, yeah.
Yeah. It can come out in many ways, I guess is the long story short, not just collaborative papers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I'm not sure this is a good last question, but since we didn't hear the 14 or whatever significant contributions, do you think if someone has written a full draft and then they send it off for a review or an edit,
just editing or reviewing a full draft, is that authorship? That was the question. I think it depends on whether the review that's being given is substantive or not. So if you have someone reviewing it and they make a couple of editorial changes, and it's the first time that they've touched it, they haven't seen it before now, then I would say that would not constitute authorship. Mm-hmm. I have actually done that. I think I had you do that for me once. And I put you in an acknowledgement. It's like, thank you to Sarah for reading a previous version of this manuscript.
Yeah. When I was very junior, my advisor asked me, he's like, you want to come on this paper? And he had me do that role. And I did do that. And I am a co-author on that paper. And ever since I thought, like, I don't think that really should have been authorship. That doesn't, because I had not ever been part of any of the conceptualization of the paper. It's very rare in my lab for that to happen because we're having conversations, you know, and you're only on it if you've at least been part of the conversations and the conceptualizations. So the active only piece of writing you might do is maybe some editing, but you have, you know, the Vancouver rules, you know, you've conceptualized it and you've read the draft and you've approved the final is enough within the Vancouver model to be an author. And I would say everybody that I work with meets that. And in this, in the,
like the class example, you know, like situations where I'm just giving some feedback on a full manuscript I've received and never talked about previously, and I do a little bit of edits, to me, that's not authorship. I would never put myself on author. That's just a, either it's part of my teaching or it's part of my supporting junior colleagues. So I might do that for a junior faculty member, or it's, you know, or a friend, you know, sometimes you just need to get unstuck and you ask a friend to unstuck you on a paper. But yeah. I'm just rambling now, but I guess I would think that that's not authorship.
So I'm thinking about it from the flip where it's like, I'm a graduate student.
Yep.
And I produced this work, and it's sort of the idea of, why don't you ask them to review it as faculty?
Yeah.
And then they give maybe not substantive edits, but it's sort of the expectation that because they're senior,
that they should be put on it.
No. So and I was actually going to, that's what I was about to transition that way, is on the flip side of that, how do you have this conversation? Like when you're coming as a student or a postdoc or an early assistant professor and it's your, you are in the, I guess, lower position of power in that situation. And this is one of the things I was just working with a student on this week, is she said, I've asked this person for some help. I'd really like them to come on and be an author. What do I do? And so we sort of talked through the email to draft. And really, it's sort of setting up the expectation in advance, which is, hi, thank you so much for the help you've given me so far. I think it's substantial enough that you should be a co-author. If you would like to come on as a co-author, I would expect that you would read the full draft and maybe give me some feedback on this section of the manuscript. If you're willing to do that, I'd love to have you as a co-author. What do you think? So approaching it from that, the setting the expectation within the email is a good way to go. And sort of similarly on the other side, if it's saying, hi, I would really, you know, I'm trying to get this solo authored piece out, but I'd really appreciate your feedback on this manuscript, and just if you could give me, would you be willing to give me a pre-review? Sort of setting that expectation in advance is, I'm asking you to do this as a mentoring sort of favor and as a mentorship activity, not as an authorship activity. That you're setting it up to be slightly different in that way.
Mm-hmm. I definitely had examples, though. I've heard of examples, and I think that's occurred in my lab, too, where you had somebody senior, and they're like, well, now I expect to be on it. And I am confrontation adverse, generally. there's something I have been working for years about changing for myself, and so I'm better at it now. But earlier in my career, especially, you know, and I was like, oh, fuck it. You know, I don't think co-authorship gives a lot. So, if, you know, do I want to piss off this senior person or whatever? And so like, okay, then they're going to be on it. I will be very careful around that situation with that person and learn my lesson and move on. And sometimes part of it is, you know, and it really comes down to like personal individual differences in how you navigate these situations. But sometimes it's like, it's, you know, is that the hill for you? It could be, or could not be. It can be, you know, it could be the hill for many reasons, or it could be, you're like, it's just not, that one is just not worth it. And I will change how I do this for others in the future. Many of my practices, why I'm even here, to be better than what I've experienced before. And maybe you're like, I'm going to be better than what I've experienced, but this situation, I'm not going to, you know. So sometimes you're playing, you know, I guess in all areas of our life, we're making that balance. And so you can, you know, make that decision of how you're going to respond in that situation, depending on that local context. Just sometimes,
I think that
just
was
let it be.
A great last question. Thank you, everyone, so much. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Within and Between. For information about this and all our episodes, you can visit our website, withinandbetweenpod.com. Connect with us on Twitter at @within_between, where you can send us questions about developmental science and developmental sciencing. See you next time.